You're listening to By the Well, a podcast for preachers where we discuss the lectionary readings to help you preach in your contexts. I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Fran Barber. Today's conversation focuses on Easter Day, specifically on the reading from Matthew 28. We're recording this podcast amidst the COVID-19 crisis, when churches are really grappling with what it means to be the body of Christ when they can't gather together. It's a time more than ever when we need to hear the good news that the risen Christ appears among us. To help us unpack what preaching the resurrection might look like, we're joined by the Reverend Dr. Craig Thompson. Craig has over 20 years parish ministry experience and is currently Minister of Mark the Evangelist Uniting Church in North Melbourne. Craig's PhD focused on the relationship of Christian faith and other ways of viewing the world. Welcome, Craig. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleased to be here.
Welcome. Craig, tell us a little bit about your community and what preaching looks like in your context.
The congregation of Mark the Evangelist is an inner city congregation quite close to the centre of Melbourne. It's a congregation which gathers people from quite a large distance, nevertheless, because it has a particular interest in a fairly high style of liturgy. We celebrate a weekly Eucharist, and the preached word is a very important part of that coming together as well. The congregation also has a strong interest in social outreach and has a small social service agency. We continue to struggle with the link between the preached word, the worshipping congregation, and the deeds of love in the local community to express how one is related to the other.
Yep. Thank you. We're going to start by unpacking
Matthew,
the gospel reading for today. This might be my favourite of the resurrection gospel narratives, I have to say.
Why?
Because it's so apocalyptic, and I do like apocalyptic things.
You do.
Matthew has inserted an earthquake here. It's not the only earthquake in Matthew. He actually has four. He has them at really key moments. There's earthquake language, there's seismos language when Jesus calms the storm. That's actually in Matthew's gospel more of an earthquake thing. He has it at Jesus' death. So if you read Matthew's gospel for the Passion, you know, when Jesus dies, there's again this cosmic upheaval that happens. And then here again, he explains the fact that, you know, the reality that somehow the tomb is broken open, the stone is moved, is explained in Matthew through this earthquake and a mighty angel coming down. And it's a richness of theophanic language here. There's bright light. The guards fall down as if dead. It's literally like a kind of a visitation of the divine in biblical terms. And I think Matthew wants us to know that Jesus' death and resurrection, and in fact his entire visitation on earth, is of cosmic significance. It is world-shaking in real terms. What did you two notice about Matthew?
Look, the thing that leapt out at me was the language of, or the exhortation, do not be afraid, and the reference to the running from the tomb.
Yes.
In fear, but also in great joy, and the tension between those struck me as something which might speak to us about what resurrection talk is indicating.
Yeah. I know that struck me too, particularly with what's going on in the world right now, that one can be both caught in great fear and great joy seems almost antithetical, and yet it's the women's response to something that is unknown, unprecedented.
I would see it as sort of awe in the old sense of, you know, the traditional sense of awe. This is awesome.
Yep. The other thing here is Matthew frames this all as a visual thing. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary go to kind of look at the tomb, to observe the tomb. I don't know if they're going to keep vigil to watch over the tomb. And it begs all sorts of questions for me as a biblical scholar. Were they expecting something to happen, or were they simply wanting to sit near their beloved Christ? You know, it's hard to interpret, to know whether that's an act of faith or grief or both.
Probably both, which is the fear and the great joy being the response.
Yeah, that's right. And the other thing at the end, which is not really the focus today, but Matthew does what Mark does when Jesus does finally appear, he tells them to go back to Galilee. And so ultimately the invitation at the end of the resurrection is for all the disciples to meet him back in Galilee, where there's a sense that the story begins again, and the story begins again with, you know, with us, with the next generations of disciples who are called to follow.
I did read somewhere, and I can't remember where, but that verses 5 to 7 are actually the whole gospel in 2 verses.
Ooh. Do not be afraid.
I know you're looking for the Jesus who was crucified. He's not here. He's risen.
Mm.
Go and tell everyone.
Yes, go and tell, being a key. Mm. And we get a similar summary in the Acts reading for today of the kind of almost synopsis of the gospel, maybe without Matthew's go and tell emphasis. Is there anything else we want to comment on here? I mean, there's also Jesus, when Jesus does appear, there's so many lovely little things. I love that this mighty angel comes down and he's like lightning and then he just sits on the stone. Like if you're visualizing this, and I know the point is not to visualize this as if it's a historical retelling of an, you know, but it's, I can imagine some like divine-like angelic being just perched on a stone just casually.
And there have been several angelic beings in Matthew.
Yes, he also likes an angel.
Telling Mary about her pregnancy, appearing to Joseph in his dream to leave Egypt.
Yep.
And Jesus' temptations.
Yep.
An angel appeared there as well.
Yeah. And but let's go to the end here, the don't be afraid. It's interesting to me Jesus greets them like that, you know, that there's not an assumption that in seeing Jesus there would be instant joy. In fact, the assumption is there's fear in encountering the resurrected Christ, even if we interpret that fear in biblical sense of awe and reverence.
Mm. Yes. It's a surprising thing, I suppose, because I suppose we are invited to imagine, to believe that this is actually an encounter with God. And in that sense, if the word fear is appropriate, it's different from the sort of things that terrify us in the world, whether at the moment in the context of the virus and the death and the isolation and the extraordinary economic impact and suffering that that's going to bring upon us. That's a fear of one sort. The fear that's indicated here in the resurrection story isn't a fear not so much of those things that might strike us dead and bring death to us, but the fear of the presence of God.
Yeah.
And in fact, to play with the way in which the presence of God might kill us in some sense might be a constructive way of reading something out of the text.
And that's what happens to the guards.
Yes, struck
dumb. Well, they're struck. They realised.
As though dead.
Yes,
as though dead. Well, they thought they were living, but when they saw Jesus, they realised they'd been dead.
Yes, that'd be a lovely way to read something out of the text, which is not immediately obviously about us. You know, it's just, it looks like something that's just happened, but to see it as the way in which some might respond to the presence of God, we all might respond to the presence of God, is an illuminating way of drawing something unexpected out of the text. Yeah,
and I think it does. It begs a couple of kinds of reflection from us as readers today. One is to sit and pause in this particular era and reflect on what are the things we're afraid of and the sort of why, and then how God might speak into those things. But what you're both hinting at, which makes biblical scholars like me get nervous, is doing this sort of slightly, really a more spiritualized reading that takes us beyond, you know, the ins and outs of what happened in the text, but we're moving into a kind of a metaphorical space, I guess, which is totally legitimate. I'm not saying it's not.
Thank you.
So let's move into that, you know, the more interpretive questions about what we do with this today. What does it mean to preach and speak of the resurrection?
Well, indeed, because in a lot of contexts, it's seen as a problem. The preacher says this is a problem or a puzzle that I've got 6 people over here who I know don't believe this.
Yeah.
And so I need to make it believable to them in this moment on this Sunday.
Or explain it or something.
Just as an aside, you are preaching the risen Lord every Sunday if you're doing your job. But so how do we get around taking this as a problem, I have to explain it, How do we proclaim the living Lord or the living Christ, risen Christ?
Yeah. And I mean, I do want to say what we should not do, which is sometimes easier than saying how we do your question, which I'm going to throw to Craig in a moment. This is not about talking about, this isn't a reversal. I mean, all those theological, like the resurrection is somehow distinct. It's not a reversal of Jesus back to his earthly whatever.
Lazarus.
You know. It's not a resuscitation. You know, there is something much grander and
unprecedented.
And unprecedented in that. But Craig, what would you do with Fran's question about what was your question, Fran?
Well, mine was not so much a question but an observation that it is the resurrection is taken to be a problem, to be pulled apart, when actually the word doesn't appear here at all in the text.
No.
Look, I think you're quite right, Fran, to say that properly every Sunday what we are dealing with is the dynamic of death and resurrection. There's a sense in which those communities, or the people in the community that gathers to hear the written and then proclaimed word and sometimes the enacted word in the sacrament, gather as a community which looks to be raised from the death which is around us and within us. And so that what is important is that act of coming together, being named and being embraced. And the naming and the embracing bring both a naming of one who is dead, and the embracing is in itself a resurrecting kind of act that God embraces us. Part of the problem of our liturgical year is it invites us or tempts us to separate those things out into separate events, where, you know, Christmas and then Good Friday and then Easter and Pentecost. Whereas every Sunday we ought to be collapsing those to some extent in the way in which John does. They're all very intimately related and not strung out over time.
Yep.
So when it comes to the question, the temptation that Easter as such, as a liturgical calendar event, presents to us is that we try to isolate it from everything else. We isolate the resurrection as an event, as in something that took place in the past, and thereby set ourselves outside of it already, rather than asking in what sense are we inside the text? In what sense is this about us? In what sense is Jesus' death our death and his resurrection our resurrection? And that's, I think, a much more constructive way for the church to see how is this is to engage the question or the fact of resurrection, the promise of resurrection.
As a promise for all of us. One of the quick ways people often talk about this is the resurrection is God's no to death. I'm conscious this year we may see more people die than, you know, of this virus. Death might be perhaps, you know, in the West at least, we're in a very death-denying culture. And yet death might be on people's minds far more than normal because of what's going on. And I get this all theologically, but there's always this tension, I feel like, for people of faith between acknowledging the reality of death, which is serious and gut-wrenching and all of those things, and then what it means to proclaim that this is God's ultimate no to death. How do you manage that tension, Craig? It's kind of a how do we preach hope without denying the horrible reality that death is.
Yes. Resurrection as God's no to death. I would want to extend a little further that resurrection is about God's yes to those who die, which is a little bit different, I think.
Oh, okay. Say more.
Well, I see the resurrection actually as a light which points us straight back to the cross and says that even though this one hanging on the cross outside of the city looks like he is God forsaken, in fact, he is still actually the beloved Son, despite everything that's happening. So the sign of the cross as a sign of having been set outside of God is revealed, in fact, to be wrongly read by those of us who look and see this one as worthless. We are mortal. We are destined to die. That's one of the distinguishing features between us and God. The question is, what do we do with that mortality? Does it hold us in its grip with fear? Mm. Do we determine that because others die in certain ways, they are less loved by God than those who die in seemingly otherwise, better ways,
yeah.
more,
yeah, that's
more
right.
attractive and comfortable ways of passing on? So the resurrection, it seems to me, says that everything that we saw in the life of Jesus, those things that we take joy in, celebrate, those things that we recognize we don't want as part of our own lives, these are all things that take place in the life of somebody who's loved by God and never not loved by God.
Mm.
It seems to me that that's saying to us that even now, not so much after we die, but in what we're experiencing right now, this too is the suffering of God, if we like. Our suffering, God is here with us. We are no less human because of what confronts us, whether it's the virus or everything else that's still going on anyway. We're distracted by the virus, but all the rest is still there. So it's of course, in one sense, a no to death, but it's no to the way in which we sign death or interpret what death actually means.
Yeah. And it flies in the face of some of the theology we're seeing out there, which wants to kind of claim that if you're a person of faith, you somehow have divine protection or, you know, that if you're just faithful enough, God will look after you. And yet the biblical narrative and the person of Jesus point very deeply to everything you're saying, is that the most beloved people of God still face terrible heart, like, you know, being a person of faith is not some magic get you out of jail free card.
Well, quite. I mean, that way of thinking separates Jesus' own experience as a human being outside of our own. If indeed he's fully incarnate, if he's living a human life, and as Paul says, if our life is somehow hidden in him, then it ought not to surprise us that what he experienced is the sort of thing that we would experience as well. We ought to expect to experience that. This notion of taking up our cross and following is to say, be human, be open to God who creates you and calls you, to be open to others in love around you, to do what Jesus did and to expect to experience what Jesus did.
I was reading something, I think it was Rowan Williams, talking about the resurrection, obviously inaugurating a whole new, it's the end times, speaking apocalyptically. And so that throws a whole new light on the way we see each other and therefore the way we see death. And that is where the space in which you speak of the hope and the promise and God's covenant continuing.
We're in this new age. It's that eschatological tension between we've been given a taste or a glimpse. To go back to the seeing language, we've glimpsed something world altering. That, you know, and so I think, you know, if we turn this to the nature of preaching, acknowledging that preaching is going to look very different this Easter. Some people are preaching
virtually,
live stream, and some people are pre-recording, and there's all sorts of creative things going on. Some people are doing written reflections, et cetera. I think the challenge, I want to ask both of you, is how we don't just retell the story but somehow invite people into an experience of the resurrected Christ. Is that the challenge, or would you want to frame that differently? Or to kind of ask the question, I guess, of how do we continue to encounter the resurrected Christ, the presence of God?
Well, I think that is the enormous challenge at these times, because generally speaking, it's in the whole liturgy and the embracing of the people where that happens.
Yep.
And I don't really have an answer how we do that now when we can't gather together.
This is why we have guests, to give us all the answers, Craig. No pressure.
It's interesting. One of the things that I've been playing with is the way in which we might be incorporated into each other. I mean, what does it mean to be part of the body of Christ?
Mm-hmm.
Last Sunday, which was Lent 2004, my congregation gathered for the last time, and we did have the Eucharist, but only I, as the liturgist, received, ate and drank. And I did that in the full sight of everybody and with an understanding which I'd given to the congregation, or an explanation I'd give to the congregation along the lines of, we can do this, though. What one does can be actually incorporating of what everybody does and experiences, if that's what we say about the way in which Jesus himself somehow in his own person incorporates all of us.
Mm-hmm.
How helpful is that? What I think it means, what I think it might make possible for us, is to imagine that even though we are scattered all over the place, and if it is breaking the bread or anything else that we normally associate it with being fully bodily participating in a gathered community and those kinds of things, that that the body of Christ has always been a widely scattered body.
Mm.
And in that sense, this is a more extreme version of that. I mean, we are lucky that we can actually join together over the internet
technology.
In a way in which we couldn't have done even 10 years ago,
yeah,
let alone 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. But we still need to be able to say something about how God is active in this space, obviously over a telephone or over an internet connection. I think that this notion of a vicarious celebration, a sense in which if it happens in one place, it's happening in all places, is a useful one. And that's sort of get back to the resurrection theme. You know, it happened in one space and time, but the point is, this is a God who makes it happen in all spaces and all times. The same kind of thing is present to all things, and the God who works through the one for the many.
Yeah.
Look, I'm thinking out loud, but it seems to me that these are things which the church is now going to have to play with, because we're confronted with literally quite unprecedented realities.
Well, I'm struck by we profess belief in the communion of saints in the creed.
Yes.
And we also tend to be quite parochial about where we go to church and our church.
Yes.
And what this time is challenging us to do is to actually, we are the communion of saints. So I'm someone who was formed in the ecumenical movement, so I've had quite an appreciation that over in Rome they're hearing the same readings we hear this morning, but they're hearing them tonight. You know, I've been in context, which is totally a foreign language to me in the church, but I've been able to follow the liturgy because there's a shape and a familiarity to it. And I've always held a wonder in that being – I mean, I know the communion of saints is over time as well, so 600 years ago, 1,000 years ago. But I do, I'm quite convinced that now is a time to play with that, teach about it, but not in a teachy way, but help people's appreciation and depth of that truth. There's a colleague, Rachel, in Yarraville Uniting Church, who is doing something like having the community sing Now Thank We All Our God each week, because that was written in the last plague through London in the 17th century.
Okay.
This is a... Yeah. The church is a community that has survived and done this, and also gone back when they were meeting to using the little communion glasses, because they were either instituted, or I think they were, during the Spanish flu.
It was powerfully reinforced by that stage.
So I find that, I mean.
So that in other words, we already have living traditions that are adaptations to previous tragedies.
And this is how the church got through. And so I think that whole playing with the communion of saints idea.
Yes.
I find that so useful when I'm, whether I'm, you know, presiding in a parish or at home by myself praying, that like to consciously remind yourself that at any given time there are Christians in an apartment in New York City or on a farm in the middle of New South Wales, but, you know, we are part of a community, a spiritual community that, you know, in many languages and all over the world, to me is deeply moving. And then you add the, you know, communion of saints, whatever that means, this, you know, there are parts of the Bible that talk about, you know, the angels praying with us and the saints praying with us, and the sense that we are not alone, even if we are physically alone.
And I'm struck too by those dreadful stories out of Italy in particular, where people are dying alone and then being taken to crematoria. Yes. Alone.
Yes, without opportunity to come together, know, to remember and yes. celebrate.
And what's yes. the word of hope and embracing we can make in those sort yeah. of straitened circumstances.
That's right. We're almost at time here. Any last thoughts or questions you'd want to pose that people could perhaps reflect upon?
I've just got one. Reading some essays, actually, my dad Bruce wrote about theological language being metaphorical, mythological, and paradoxical. It's a whole, long paper. But the reality that the resurrection, as we call it, was first called by Paul in Corinthians as an appearance. He appeared to me. Not I saw him, but he appeared to me. So something dramatic happened. And the whole notion of appearance and playing with that word appearance, the fact that it appears in the Matthew reading today and it's also in the Acts reading. So I think that's a good way for preaching about the appearance, the continued appearance and presence of God, getting around the problem I mentioned earlier that can be of the resurrection language.
Yes. The notion that it's an event we have to sort of analyse. Yeah.
I can't put a link to the paper, I'm afraid, because it's not online. But
to speak of the resurrection as the continuing presence of Jesus as the Son within which we have our own life, that sums that up, I think, that what he was for his contemporary community is what he continues to be for us now. That's the substance of it.
Yep. And in all those examples you just cited, Fran, it's the movement of God towards us. It's the movement of Christ towards us.
Right.
We don't need to run to the tomb like Mary.
No.
But rather maybe wait and make space for the presence of God to come to us.
And that those stories actually came after Paul, 30 years after Paul said he appeared to me.
Yeah, yes. That's right.
Interesting.
Well, thank you so much, Craig Thompson, for being with us today.
It's been great.
We appreciate it. You've been listening to By the Well.
A podcast brought to you with the support of the Uniting Church in Australia and Pilgrim Theological College.